Here is the reading from John, the first chapter, the first 18 verses without verse 15, which doesn't really fit. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through that Word, and without the Word, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in the Word was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light, so that all might believe through the light. John himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the true light which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not recognize him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, or of the will of the flesh, or of the will of humans, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen the glory of the Creator's only child, full of grace and truth. From this fullness we have received grace upon grace. The law was indeed given through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God's only child who is close to God's heart, who has made God known.
In August, I went to a retreat in the mountains of North Carolina at a beautiful place called Valley Crucis, an Episcopal center not too far from Boone. The retreat was titled The Enneagram and Christian Wisdom. It was connected to other wisdom-related programs some of us have been participating in over the last several years, drawing from the teachings of people like Cynthia Bourgeau, Richard Rohr, Father Thomas Keating, and even G.I. Gurdjieff. Five of us, you may remember, went to a wisdom school in Pennsylvania a few years ago. We had a one-day retreat here that same year, sharing some of that with more of you. Others of us have gone on to workshops or taken online courses. To those of you who haven't gotten as plugged into this wisdom business, it may seem like the main result of all of it has been that we now have chant and a moment of silence in worship, and that we offer Saturday evening prayer in a very contemplative way. But there's a lot more to wisdom than that, although wisdom is about practices, ways we center our lives in God, ways to live more fully and mindfully. Anyway, on the way to this North Carolina retreat, I visited with some of my family, including my sister and her husband, Jesse. Jesse's a Cornell graduate, actually, has a master's in entomology from Columbia, spent his career working at the Museum of North Carolina Museum of Science. He's fascinated by all things plants and animals, and he's our family go-to. You know, we send him pictures. What is this bug? You know, what is this snake? You know, why are there barn swallows in my garage? I mean, those kind of questions we always send to Jesse. He's the kind of person we know well here in Ithaca, someone who knows and loves this physical world, someone deeply distressed about climate change and not particularly religious. So Jesse's great because he often asks Bill and I, the ministers in the family, really good questions about religious and spiritual things. And this time his question was, what is this wisdom business? Well, I've had to stop and do some thinking about that. How do I answer that? What is wisdom? What are we talking about when we say a retreat is about Christian wisdom, much less the Enneagram? That's another whole thing. And Enneagram can be part of wisdom, but I'm not even going to try to tackle the Enneagram side of it this morning. I'm certainly not the expert. I showed up at that retreat as a student, not the teacher. But I'd like to talk a little bit about wisdom today. I mean, we all know something about wisdom. We know the word. We have a general sense of something about what wisdom means, and we can certainly tell when a person is wise. There's a certain quality in a person who has wisdom. Depth, insight, calmness, someone you go to for advice when you're having a hard time. The dictionary says wisdom is the quality of having experience, knowledge, and good judgment, and also that it's a body of knowledge and principles. So wisdom is about what we know, but it's also about how we act. Wisdom is about our practices, our way of being in the world, and our ways of understanding both our physical and spiritual world. Writers like Cynthia Bourgeau and Richard Rohr reference what they call the perennial philosophy or perennial wisdom, the wisdom that is sort of at the source of all spiritual traditions, because there are shared truths, shared mystical understandings, even some shared practices that can be found across different religions and spiritual paths. And if you take time to study or learn more about great spiritual teachers across the religious and spiritual spectrum, it seems that the deeper they go, the closer together they come in many ways. It's no accident that Thomas Merton was in Thailand meeting with Buddhist monks when he died. Cynthia Bourgeau has also helped me see Jesus as a wisdom teacher, not so much a prophet and certainly not a priest, but as a rabbi, someone who used parables and his own living and dying to teach his disciples about wisdom. And of course, all traditions have wisdom teachers, and each tradition kind of has their own take on wisdom. In fact, the image that was used at this retreat, initially, one of the leaders, Jonathan Steele, was talking, and he initially talked about the hand, the idea that there's this stream of wisdom that's sort of the source, but then all the different fingers are the different traditions that kind of go off in different ways. But later when he was talking, he used more the image or metaphor of a river. And maybe because I grew up in a river delta in Bangladesh, I could really picture or think about if you've ever seen pictures of the Mississippi when it gets down New Orleans. Here's this big river, but then it spreads out in all these different streams, all from the fountain of life, the same source of wisdom, but flowing out in different directions. Some of you have made some of your spiritual journey along streams other than the Christian one. Buddhism, Sufi mysticism, Judaism, different paths that have been very meaningful to your spiritual journey, but somehow here you've found those streams coming back together with the Christian stream or merging, and this is a place where we're okay with that. We like the mixing and the mingling. We like learning from other traditions. But it was interesting that Jonathan also went on to talk, using that metaphor, that he said a stream of water doesn't go much of anywhere if it doesn't have banks, if it doesn't have a course. And so he talked about how it's good to choose a stream to follow. Not to say the other tradition is bad or wrong or judge it in any way, but to say, try to recognize what stream you're in, claim it, the stream, and go with it, that you'll get further and certainly faster if you kind of utilize the practices and ways of knowing of a particular spiritual tradition. It's an interesting idea. And I want to invite you, I guess, today to swim a while with me in the Christian wisdom river. Talk about that particular one a little bit. In the Bible, wisdom is clearly about right living, righteousness, in relationship to others and to God. Proverbs says the fear of God, as in the awe, reverence, respect of God, is the beginning of wisdom. And the whole book of Proverbs is full of teachings attributed to King Solomon about how to live wisely in relation to others, to the world, and to God. It's interesting that in Proverbs and other Hebrew scriptures, wisdom is often personified as a woman. Proverbs 4:6, do not forsake wisdom and she will protect you. Love her and she will watch over you. Feminist theologians have claimed these passages to show us as wisdom is an expression of the divine feminine, a balance to so much masculine, patriarchal language for God in our Christian wisdom river. In Proverbs 8, we read that wisdom was present with God from the beginning. From the start of creation, wisdom was there as God began. Before anything else was created, wisdom was there as a part of helping bring order out of chaos, active in the creation of all that is. That sounds to me a lot like what Mark just read from John 1 about the Word, the Logos in Greek. Logos was a Greek philosophical concept. And the writer of John's Gospel at the end of the first century was trying to make those connections to the Greek world, the Greek way of understanding, and bring and connect them to the Christian experience. Logos, the Word in Greek classical thought, meant the divine reason, the divine organizing principle, immanent in everything in nature, but also available to us as human beings. The Word is the divine, the holy, active and present in all of creation. So the Gospel of John says this Word of God was with God from the beginning. Without the Word, not one thing came into being, and that the Word is a source of life, the light of all people, the light which shines in the darkness that the darkness can never overcome. But then John's Gospel goes on to dare to claim that this Word was specifically revealed to us in Jesus the Christ. There is what we would call a very high Christology in John. Even more than in the other Gospels, John's Gospel is very clear that Jesus the Christ is one with God. John would say that Jesus isn't just a wisdom teacher, but Jesus is the wisdom itself. Jesus was the true light which enlightens everyone coming into the world. Then John goes on to critique his own people who did not recognize him. Bill Abels isn't here today, but he has helped me become much more sensitive to this aspect of the Gospel of John, because over and over again in John, you find these little messages, these little critiques of Judaism, of the Jewish people. A lot of times it's to the Jews, as in the Jewish leaders. So it helps us to understand that when John's Gospel was written, it's the latest Gospel, end of first century, after the fall of Jerusalem, and by that point, Christian church and Judaism had split. Christianity was no longer a sect of Judaism, because Pharisaic Judaism, what survived the destruction of the temple and the end of all the priestly aspects of Judaism, was no longer felt like they could be tolerant of these different little sects kind of going off in different directions. They felt like to survive, they need to say, this is what it means to be a Jew. This is what we believe, and this is how we act. That's how they survived for 2,000 years. And the Christians, more and more and more, were Gentiles. People much more influenced by Greek language and culture, and with less and less understanding and appreciation of Jewish tradition. And so there was a split with some pretty hard feelings on both sides. And we see that in John's Gospel. Sadly, tragically, John's Gospel has been used to justify anti-Semitism on the part of Christians over the centuries. But John's essential point here is not about the Jews. His essential point is incarnation, to use a theological word. It is that the Word, the immanent reality of God, God acting, spreading out and revealing God's self, was made flesh, made human, dwelt among us. The phrase in Greek literally means pitched his tent with us. The divine reason, the wisdom of God, came to be one with us. And in Jesus, John claims, we have seen the glory of God, full of grace and truth. The glory as of the Creator's only child, only begotten one, revealed to us, present with us. From him, he says, we have received grace upon grace. No one's ever seen God, but this only child who is close to the heart of God has made God known to us. God revealed to us, living with us, abiding with us in and through Jesus the Christ. Now I know we all get bogged down a little bit. We want to make sure we still value those other streams, right? And this, the particular claims, the unique claims about Jesus can get us in trouble in the way we want to live in relation to others. This is the point where Richard Rohr and others talk about the cosmic Christ or Christ consciousness. That Jesus, that man who lived in the first century, who was a revelation of us of God, was part of something so much bigger. The Christ, Christ in the world, the revealing of God's self, and that Jesus points us to that, reveals that to us, but Jesus of Nazareth doesn't contain all of that. It's bigger and more because it's still here. Christ is still here with us, in us, among us. But that somehow in Jesus Christ, there is revealed to us the heart of God. The heart of God. Bishop John Spong, in his writing about the Gospel of John, urges us to see the book of John, the Gospel of John, as a mystical work. John's Gospel has been used a lot for doctrine, for like the right ways to believe, and a sort of a source for theology. And Spong's argument is that's not what John's about. That is not what John's about. It's about ways, it's meant to open us up to the ways we can know and relate to God. And for God, for John, that primary way is Jesus, the Christ, directly connecting us to God, one with God. I abide in you, you abide in me, we know God's love as we know love through Jesus Christ. So I think the way of wisdom, to get back to that, tells us, do not turn these words from John into theological formulas, the plan of salvation. Don't try to make them into prescriptions for orthodox belief. And don't try to understand them with just your mind. You'll get frustrated and confused. The way of wisdom is about opening ourselves up, letting ourselves know with a deeper kind of knowing. Again and again, I have this memory of our daughter Anna in middle school. Anna could always ask hard questions, always, from the time she was tiny. And she was full of tough theological questions in early adolescence. And I finally said to her, Anna, I don't have the words to tell you everything you're asking. And I finally said to her, you know, the kind of learning, the kind of knowing that you're learning in school is not going to help you with these God questions. I said to her, do you know that I love you? And she said, yeah, I do. I said, okay, good. That's the kind of knowing that will help you get to God. You cannot get to God just through here. You have to get to God through through love. Our minds cannot comprehend God, but our hearts, our full not just emotion, but our full spiritual selves can love God and can experience God's love. God is love, and the only way to know that is through love. God is so much bigger. We can't even put names on it, right? God is such a limited term. divine energy, creativity, the source, the ground of being, whatever word you want to use is not enough. Love is what takes us. Love is what allows us to know. That's the way of wisdom. So I close with a few short sayings, notes I made in my notebook at the retreat. Salvation is not about getting out of here. It's about getting here more. The way we get here is through being alive, becoming co-creators in this unfinished universe. The shift that happens is you. If Jesus is the Word of God, then we are all words of God, more verbs than nouns. We are all called to reveal God, to become little Christ. Everything we do matters for everyone, everywhere, through all time. We are all in this together.